On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Two big headlines out of China about Walmart. First, the retail giant is on a billion-dollar expansion spree that will make it the biggest food and department store network in all of China. Astounding, but typical. Walmart now selling turtle blood in Beijing. The second headline, not so typical. In fact, it sounds extraordinary. Walmart, the biggest private employer in America that has always barred the door to labor unions, is going union in China. What that means is a matter of debate for China, for Chinese workers, for American workers, and maybe for workers in Bangladesh. Up next on Point, the inside story on cheap stuff, China, world wages, and Walmart. Joining me now from the Chinese capital, Beijing, is Joe Kahn, Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. He's been closely following China's labor and union issues. Joe, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Good to be with you.
First to Walmart, Joe. How big is it now? And we're reading here it's on track to become the biggest food and department store network in all of China. How's that happening?
It's not there yet. Actually, Walmart took its time coming into China and tested the waters fairly cautiously at first, and even today it's still behind some other foreign retailers, including the French retailer Carrefour, and a number of Chinese chains. But Walmart is stepping up the pace quickly. It bought out a Taiwanese company that had about 100 stores around China, and it's expanding very quickly now.
A $1 billion purchase there. The Wall Street Journal says world's largest retailer would become the biggest food and department store network in China. There's competition for that, but getting very big. Why is China such an important, apparently, an important market for Walmart, Joe?
Well, it's probably the only really large market that is still undefined by either a strong retail tradition or a certain chain. I mean, it's wide open competition-wise. There's a huge infrastructure going into China. The roads are all going in. People are open to foreign brands. And at least traditionally, union representation was weak, and that was an important consideration for Walmart, which had a difficult entry, for example, into Germany, also had a difficult time trying to penetrate South Korea.
They basically gave up on Germany and South Korea, but going full steam ahead in China. We'll look at the union issue, but if an American would go into a Walmart in China, Joe Kahn, what's it look like? I mean, we're reading here about tanks full of live crab and clams and stingrays and crayfish and squid. Is it a wholly different thing or something familiar?
Well, it's clearly tailored to the Chinese context, but the basic Walmart big box idea, everything under one roof for lower prices than you would find elsewhere, prevails in China as well. A lot of the products are suited to what local people want to buy, but they have a range of everything from electronics to fashion to pharmaceutical products to live food, which is demanded by Chinese consumers.
And carved pig's head, jellied pig skin, heat and serve Peking duck. So you've got the full gamut there. Joe, what about this? In America, we look at Walmart as a source of very low-cost products that come from China. So in China, are their products low-cost, or are these sort of middle-of-the-consumer-chain products there, or do they look the same to the Chinese as to American consumers?
Obviously, they're sourcing a lot of their supply from China, and so the Chinese consumer is used to very low prices. But I do think that Walmart, in that context, provides competitive prices and a relatively good standard of quality compared to the local brands. I mean, one of the biggest problems in China is false labeling. trademark and copyright violations, that sort of thing. I think that Walmart, while it probably can't exclude those kinds of items from its shelves, it is trying to position itself as a more trusted brand that can sell you something that, you know, is what it says it is on the package, good value for money, that kind of thing.
And what about letting unions into their stores? We're reading here 30,000 Walmart workers in China already, and an agreement wrapped up recently that will have unions coming into those stores. What kind of union, and why did Walmart agree?
Importantly, it's not unions with an S on the end. It's union. It's the Communist Party's national, what's called the All China Federation of Trade Unions, which is a Communist Party organization based in Beijing, which is, in essence, the monopoly union in the country, which traditionally, at least ideologically, did not have any labor strife. It was a socialist paradise. So this was a kind of a bureaucratic coordinating entity which operates in an entirely different way from unions as we know them in the West. There's no collective bargaining. Traditionally, there hasn't been any grassroots organizing. They're not antagonistic with management. In fact, all of the dues for the union are paid directly by management. None of them are paid directly by the workers. So the union process in China tends to be a negotiation between the state monopoly organization and companies. But Walmart was a particular sore point for them because essentially it came into China with its pretty heavily anti-union American style aggressive push, and the state union doesn't like that very much. Usually it's been able to slip in very quietly when it targets a big company and set up its shop there and collect the 2% of wages that it's entitled to under law. And then basically nothing happens. I mean, they don't really aggressively push for reforms. They don't lobby for higher wages. But Walmart pushed the wrong button, basically, and they got much more active than they have been historically, decided they needed to make a stand, and they pressed Walmart very hard.
Because even on this kind of management-friendly union, Walmart was saying no, but they finally got in there. We see wages are rising rapidly in China, but does this kind of union look more like labor empowerment or control of labor?
I think it's more the latter. The role of the union and the reason the union has become more active recently is that there has been a considerable amount of labor-oriented unrest in China. The Communist Party is concerned about social stability. There are many thousands, probably hundreds of thousands, of privately owned companies around China that do not have any representation in the union. And the leadership put one and one together and decided that they needed to expand the purview of this union, which traditionally sort of limited itself to big state-owned manufacturing enterprises. I think that the primary purpose is to try to undercut any support for really true independent worker unions or collective bargaining that could somehow present some sort of a challenge to the monopoly party, the monopoly power of the Communist Party.
Independent unions, not legal in China at this point, as we understand.
No, they're forbidden by law. Collective bargaining can only take place in the context of the state umbrella union, and in practice, it doesn't happen. Also, strikes are illegal under Chinese law, and the state union has, to my knowledge, never organized a strike on behalf of workers.
So there we are, independent unions, not legal, a kind of union now in Walmart. It sounds unorthodox, but maybe it's not how what it appears from afar. We've got a debate about that we'll look at. Joe Kahn with the New York Times in Beijing, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Good to talk to you.
I want to go now to Hong Kong and Anita Chan, research fellow at the Australian National University's Contemporary China Center. She's author of China's Workers Under Assault. Anita Chan, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi. So here, thank you for inviting me.
It's great to have you. We get this news that sounds very strange. Walmart, which does not allow unions. Anita, are you there?
Yeah.
What does it mean, you're writing, that it actually is significant, that this state union is in Walmart stores in China now? How do you interpret the significance of it?
Well, the significance of it is that it is the first time ever that the ACFTU, the official trade union, has organized union branches at enterprise level by going to the grassroots since the Communist Party took power in 1949.
In other words, since Walmart would not play directly with them, they actually went and organized workers to demand from within.
Right. Yeah, they did, and that's the first time they've done it. And now it is unclear exactly how many of the Walmart stores were organized this way. By now, it's been how many months? Maybe two and a half months. All the Walmart stores in China have been organized. But at least for the first 10 or more that we have information of, the stores were organized, the unions there were organized from the grassroots.
And now that same union targeting other foreign firms, including Kodak and Dell, and it raises a very interesting picture. Anita Chan, you say the Western media has generally dismissed this move, says Walmart's finally, with the attitude that Walmart has finally found a union it can live with, suggesting not a very aggressive one. But you're saying there is something going on here with Chinese labor. How would you describe it?
Well, there is something going on, but I wouldn't say that it's the kind of union that we have in the West. So we have to look at it in the Chinese context, and that is Chinese unions are usually formed from the top down. That's because it came out from the socialist system, under the Mao system. That's how unions were formed. They didn't even have to be formed. In fact, they just existed automatically. But now that in China there are all these foreign-funded enterprises and private enterprises, the situation has changed. And it is the first time that the union, instead of just going to management and asking them for permission to set up a union, they literally went and did it from the grassroots, organized it secretly without Walmart knowing. And I think they have done maybe about 10 or so such unions. They've done it in, but it's not sure exactly how many unions, how many of the 60-some Walmart unions now in China were organized this way. But at least those that emerged in the very beginning were organized this way.
Now this same big state union is saying it's going to target other foreign companies in China, Kodak and Dell and others, particularly those who might resist unions. How do you interpret that, Anita Chan? Are they really trying to give workers more leverage? Are they just trying to put money in the Communist Party coffers? Are they trying to advantage Chinese national companies against foreign competition?
Well, the last one about foreign competition, I don't think that is right. I don't think that's the correct way of looking at it. Nothing about foreign competition, no. But there is nationalism, a nationalistic feeling that they don't want to be pushed around by foreign companies like Walmart, which came in and said, no, we are not going to organize trade unions because... according to the Chinese trade union law, they're supposed to have unions, although it is not illegal not to have unions. However, it is illegal if the if management obstructs the Chinese trade union from organizing. So that is why that's quite different from the way we look at it, from how it's looked at normally. Okay, a lot of people will say, yes, the union is after the money, but it goes beyond that, I think.
So it's a more complicated picture than it appears, but we've become accustomed to the idea that what happens there has a big impact
one way or another on American workers and American consumers. Anita Chan in Hong Kong, please stand by for just a moment. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington, Thea Lee. She's Policy Director and Chief International Economist at the AFL-CIO. Thea Lee, thanks very much for being with us. What do you make of this latest move with Walmart and the state union in China? Does this mean something, nothing? Are labor rights changing in China or not?
I think a lot of things are changing in China. And China's really at a crossroads as it tries to figure out how to deal with the global economy, how to deal with labor unrest at home, how to address all these issues. And I think there's a lot of irony in the Walmart issue. As Joe Kahn pointed out and as Anita pointed out, the Chinese, the ACFTU, the Chinese labor body, is not a real union. It doesn't meet the standards of what a union is, which is that it's elected by its members, it represents the interests of workers, it's independent of management, independent of the government. And yet this is an interesting development that's happening here. And you see that actually the Chinese government in this case has stood up to Walmart better than the U.S. government. It's actually illegal in the United States to declare that you won't have a union, even if your workers want one. And yet the Bush administration has failed to enforce our own labor laws against Walmart. And you see the Chinese government standing up and saying, well, at least it says on paper you have to have something resembling a union, and they were pushing for that. So I think that's an interesting point, and I think Anita's point is interesting as well, that Walmart's resistance has pushed the ACFTU to try a different strategy at Walmart than they've used in the rest of the country.
But it was only a few months ago that the AFL-CIO, that you were very tough on China, saying people are getting 15 cents an hour there, 50 cents an hour there, the kind of big sweatshop picture. You called on the Bush administration to enforce trade law on China, to look at sanctions if they didn't improve those labor conditions. Are you now saying, okay, China's doing better, they're doing all right, or not?
Absolutely not. We totally stand by the petition that we filed a couple of months ago, and the main things in China haven't changed. China still outlaws independent unions. China still is egregiously out of compliance with its international obligations, with its legal obligations to respect the fundamental human rights of its workers. There's been some small changes happening in China, and I think the Walmart change is a small one, not a large one, but it's important. It's in the right direction as opposed to the wrong direction. But we still believe that our government needs to put tremendous pressure on China to come into compliance with its international obligations and allow real unions to form, allow independent unions to form at Walmart, in the industrial sector, in the state-owned sector, everywhere, because right now, today in China, workers do not have the right to stand up at the workplace and say, I want to form a union of my own choosing. And that's really important. It's an economic issue and it's a moral issue for Americans.
We can clearly understand what that might cost Chinese workers, but what does that cost American workers, in your view, Thea Lee?
Well, it's costing us hundreds of thousands of jobs and downward pressure on our wages and pressure on our ability to build the kind of living standards that we want here in this country. There's a huge economic impact. We have about a $200 billion trade deficit with China. It's growing every minute. And our policymakers seem to be asleep. They're just not paying attention. China is violating many, many international rules. It's manipulating its currency. It's violating its workers' rights. It's subsidizing its exports. And our own government seems to be paying no attention whatsoever. And we have domestic manufacturers that are getting hurt, as well as workers, as well as farmers here in the United States. And so this is hugely important to the American middle class. It's not so much a question of whether we're going to trade with China. Of course we are. This is a huge country. It's an important economic partner. And this trade relation is important to us, but we need to set the terms of that trade relationship much better than we've done.
Anita Chan, in Hong Kong, how does the Chinese government in Beijing look at this? Are they really worried about internal labor strife? Do they have a lot of it already? And what about their international image of China as a kind of big sweatshop? Does that bother them?
I think it does. It does somewhat. Especially the Chinese trade union, it bothers them. And in fact, if you go to Beijing, you talk to some of them, they are actually themselves quite flabbergasted at what's happening in the southern China, because a lot of the serious exploitation happens in Guangdong province, where there are a lot of these Asian-funded supplier factories to brand-name companies. So in this sense, they are trying to do something, but it is an enormous task ahead of them. I mean, they are constrained as they have always been by the party, I mean, the trade union itself, in a way, is somewhat split in China. Some people are more willing to try to do something new.
I'm looking here at a story from Business Week magazine about the upward pressure on salaries. This is in a factory in the southern part of China that makes lamps and furniture for Walmart and Home Depot and Target and Pottery Barn. It says last year salaries were up 40%. Now it's still just to an average of $160 a month, but even without unions, is the Chinese wage really on that steep a climb, Anita Chan?
No, I've just been in China, in South China. I've been doing some research. I just don't see wages have gone up by 40%. I don't know where this figure comes from, because based on my own research, it hasn't. In fact, it has barely changed. And don't forget, even if it has gone up, it is because for the last 12 to 13 years, wages have gone down. So, I mean, that means the workers have been losing for many, many years, and even if now it's gone up a little bit, it is not catching up at all.
You got a big picture here that matters. Hard to figure out the details with contradictory signals like that. Let's take a call. Nick is calling from Brookfield, Connecticut. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Hello. Say, I was just wondering, 2% of the workers' wages is a big chunk of change.
Yes, it is.
At the small numbers that you're talking at.
Yeah.
And I'm very pro-unionist, but what are the workers going to get for this? It looks to me like nothing. And when you talk about price increases, all I see is the entrepreneurs making more money, and the bureaucracy, if you will, of the union or government taking in a bunch of money, which nobody seems to account for since they're not negotiating with anybody. Where is this money going?
Let's look at it. Thea Lee, that 2% of wages that goes to the state union, what do they get for it, Nick asks.
Well, they don't get much for it, and that goes right to the heart of whether this is a real union or just another government body. And, you know, obviously workers in China need union representation. They need to be able to exercise their voice at work and stand up for themselves. And so paying 2% to the government in a fee that they never see for union, so-called union leaders that they don't even know about, is not a good deal for Chinese workers.
Let's take a call from Annapolis, Maryland. And Chuck, hi, Chuck, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm not surprised at all at the marriage of Walmart, a perfect anti-union capitalist, with the Chinese government unions leaving the workers out in the cold. It brings back all the things that George Orwell wrote in Animal Farm, where the pigs, who were the leading organizers of the farm workers who worked out in the field, joined up with the farmers at the end and exploited the pigs, the horses, and the other animals.
So you get Walmart and the Chinese government kind of lash at the hip here, and it looks like an old story, not a pretty one to you.
Right, and a marriage of true love, not convenience.
Well, Chuck, thanks for your call. Anita Chan, what about it? Long term, the Chinese economy is booming. There has been plenty of labor unrest there. Do you see China as a place that long term is going to be suppressing labor rights and wages, or might Chinese workers find a voice, stand up at some point?
Well, the long term situation is difficult to say. I think it is quite gloomy situation, but it is not just only because of the Chinese government. Look, the multinationals are paying less and less for for what they are buying from China. If you look at some of the brands, you know, they are driving the prices down year by year, and that is why the wages are going down year by year. Until now, it's gone down so much that workers are not coming to work in these factories anymore. It's not worth working in those factories.
Thea Lee, we've read about foreign companies, American companies, lobbying very hard against higher wages and more unionization in China. What do you know about that?
Well, this is an outrageous development that's just come to light, which, you know, the multinational corporations, the U.S. business alliance that promotes trade with China, always wants to sell itself as the good guys. They're bringing high moral values, American standards, labor rights to China. And in fact, behind the scenes, what we've known for a long time is that these same companies, the Chamber of Commerce and these big multinational corporations, are in fact lobbying the Chinese government against any move towards increasing wages or strengthening unions or reforming labor law. And I think that hypocrisy really goes to the heart of what's wrong with the global economy today, that American companies, multinational companies that are so powerful and so wealthy and their profits are so high are reluctant even to pay Chinese workers a subsistence wage. They don't even want to allow the small labor law reforms that might make some difference, that would be an incremental move towards change in China that's so overdue.
Anita Chan, what gives foreign companies, American companies, so much leverage in this great big producing country, China, so much leverage that even there they can push down prices and wages?
It's not just in China they have such leverage. It's all over the world that they are doing it. So, I mean, China needs the foreign investment. And so, in a way, it has its eyes half closed with the exploitation. And it is really getting out of hand. If you look at the rapid rate of increase and the number of factories that's springing up every year, it is really impossible for any trade union in the world to organize them.
And what about, we've heard for a long time that there were millions and hundreds of millions more Chinese in the countryside waiting to come into those factories. Is that also still a source of downward pressure on wages there?
Yeah, that continues to be, except the skilled workers are really in great demand. By skilled workers, I mean people with some technical skill, not so much people working on the production line. Those on the production line who still, you know, they are still there. They are still available. They still want to come, working at very low wages, and wages have been going down.
Anita Chan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thea Lee, can you draw a straight line between the Chinese wage and American wages?
I don't know if it's a straight line, but it's a wiggly line, and it's definitely a strong one, that because of the sheer size of the Chinese economy and labor force, because China also has a very aggressive and successful industrial export strategy, and because it is so systematically repressive of workers' rights, China is a factor to be reckoned with in the global labor market, and that includes the United States. So what China's choices, the choices that the Chinese government makes to brutally repress any movement towards strikes or independent unions, has an impact on a worker in Michigan at a factory floor, because that worker goes to his or her boss and says, you know, we need a raise, we need a union, we need a bathroom break, we need health care. And the boss is very likely to say, shut up and get back to work, because if you don't, and we're not going to give you any of those things, we're moving to China. And in China, we don't have to worry about stuff like that. And so the global competition is very direct, and our policymakers have heightened the extent to which American workers are in direct competition with workers in China whose basic human rights are violated every day. And that happens, we hear it from Bangladeshi workers or South African or Guatemalan workers. This is happening all around the world.
We've been joined from Washington by Thea Lee, Policy Director and Chief International Economist at the AFL-CIO. Right now, we're joined from New York by James King. He'd been a journalist in Asia for 2 decades. He was Beijing Bureau Chief for the Financial Times from 98 until just last year. He's author of China Shakes the World, A Titan's Rise and Troubled Future, and The Challenge for America. James King, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
So how do you look at this whole debate over China and wages and Walmart there? I mean, it's already something to get our heads around that Walmart's selling there. We thought they just bought there. Now they're there. They've got a kind of a union. Do you see any hope of real Chinese labor leverage power, or do you see this as just a kind of a control mechanism for Chinese labor?
I would agree with Joe Kahn at the beginning of the program saying that really this is a control mechanism. I think the Chinese government is keen on, above all, maintaining harmony in its factories. And, of course, that harmony has been breaking down over the last 10 years. There are countless instances of labor unrest all over the country. And I think that's the main reason why they're keen to get this Communist Party union, which isn't really a union in any real sense of the word at all. It's an instrument of Communist Party control into the factories across China.
Give us some examples of the kind of labor unrest you're talking about there. How serious and what have you seen? What have you written about?
There are so many, really. It's difficult to point at any particular one. But I covered one, I think, about 5 years ago where a whole city, or a whole town at least, rose up, and there was a battle between the members of a mine. It was a molybdenum mine. That's a type of resource that goes into making steel, mm-hmm. That had been shut down by the Communist Party authorities. And the miners there, some 20,000 of them, had not been given the compensation that they were owed because the local officials had skimmed that money off. Mm-hmm. And the whole place erupted into a kind of a powder keg, and the People's Armed Police were there. There were shots fired. There were buildings looted. There was the whole thing had turned into a very nasty episode. But that's just one. I mean, there've been really countless examples of that type of unrest.
We're reading recently about the new cadre of Chinese billionaires, and there are plenty of them at this point. A lot of booming economic growth there. Do you see a point at which, James King, that turns into labor power? Higher wages.
I don't think that. I do think that wages are rising, and I couldn't quite make out what Anita was saying about wages falling over the last 10 mm-hmm. years. I've been to hundreds of factories across China in that time, and what I see is that Chinese wages are rising, especially along the coastal areas. It's true that a lot of inland China is being opened up. As the wages rise on the coast, factories are moving inland, and those wages are about what they were about, 5-10 years ago along the coast. So there is that situation going on, but overall, I think the trend is definitely upward. But the problem for American workers and those in Europe as well, and in my book I describe the distress of both American workers in the Midwest and in the middle of Europe because of this labor shock that's happened. But the problem with those for those people are that even though Chinese wages are rising quite appreciably now, the differential is still so huge between European and U.S. wages and those in China that really it won't have much of an impact for several years to come. China will still be the price setter for low-cost labor around the world. And I think another point that hasn't yet come out in the program is that this isn't just a sweatshop phenomenon. China is climbing a technology ladder at a very rapid rate. Engineers and all the rest. So what happens now is that you're getting people working for wages that were less than those in the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in the UK some 200 years ago in real terms, working in factories where you have the latest 21st century equipment and management and supply chain arrangements. And that is what is hitting these economies in the US and Europe much harder, I think. But it's not a low-tech phenomenon. It's really a mid-tech and even getting towards a high-tech phenomenon now.
And even at the low end, where Chinese wages can be very low, or maybe they're in the middle too, we're now hearing American international firms talking about wages being too high, saying they're reaching, as low as they are, they're reaching a break point in China. They're starting to rethink where to locate facilities, whether deeper into the interior of China or to Vietnam, to Indonesia, to Africa.
Yes, I think that's happening. Vietnam particularly has been a big beneficiary, but it's also been a beneficiary partly because there is fear now among these multinationals that the world is going to have a backlash against China. In other words, the electorates and the constituencies and the unions in Europe and America are going to pressure their governments to throw up protectionist barriers towards China. And if that was to happen, the multinationals think, then we need to have our eggs not all in the China basket, but dispersed in places like Vietnam, etc. But I think the difference with China now is that, as I said a minute ago, it's not just a sweatshop anymore. And some of the low-end stuff may be moved to Africa, and you mentioned Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Vietnam, and Indonesia. But a lot of the more key manufacturing will remain in China. And I think we should remember that foreign direct investment going into Chinese factories is rising at about $60 billion a year. So it's still a very, very major trend.
James King, Thiele, let me turn to our listeners. A lot of them want to join the two of you. David's calling from Bridgewater, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Just two questions. One is, what's exactly stopping the unions from entering Walmart? And the other one was, I've traveled to China.
You mean in the U.S., David? Why aren't they in there in the United States?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I've traveled to China, Vietnam, and actually Africa as well. And I think that it's an interesting trend that's happening where your caller from or your gentleman from New York is mentioning that there's this upward trend of China entering the middle and upper high-end tech, which then would move on to the low-tech going to Vietnam, then that would move up, and the low-tech going to Africa, then that would move up. Is that what's happening, and could this union in China actually take a turn and actually China realize that they could use this to raise their wages and create more consumers among Chinese?
Maybe, though, James King is saying, even in some of those higher-end manufacturing facilities, you've got very old-fashioned wages. Thea Lee, first to you. I mean, here's another big issue, but David asks, how has Walmart kept the wall so effectively up against unions in the United States? And then there's the question of, is there not a point at which China, too, becomes a consumer society and the whole system begins to flow more productively, beneficially for everyone?
Those are two excellent questions. On the first one, Walmart has aggressively fought unions in this country to the point of breaking the law, firing workers who even mentioned that they're interested in a union, closing whole shops, closing Walmart stores where a union has been voted on. And that happened in Canada. It happened here in the United States when the butchers in Walmart decided to form a union. They voted to form a union. And Walmart decided they didn't need that piece of the operation anymore. So Walmart has a whole army of union busters that they bring in at the first sign of anything. And they should be in jail. They are violating American law because we do have the right to form unions here in the United States. We have to fight for it every single day. But it is really a disgrace that the Bush administration has failed to enforce labor laws against Walmart for its virulently anti-union stance.
So there's a long history there. What about the Chinese side?
On the question about what's going to happen, I think that the happy ending to this story would be that there will be labor law reforms and freedoms in China, and Chinese workers will be able to join the middle class at the rate which they deserve, where that reflects their productivity and their wages begin to reflect their productivity. Then we could have a more reciprocal trade relationship between China and the United States. It could be mutually beneficial. It isn't really that today. The $200 billion trade deficit is the largest single bilateral deficit between any two countries in the history of the world. This is a tremendously lopsided relationship. And I wanted to say one thing in response to James King's interesting remarks, which is he talks about the political pressures to throw up protectionist barriers here in the United States. I would see it differently, which is that China is actually violating its international obligations under the WTO. By manipulating its currency, it is creating an artificially low price in China, which is not a natural result of market forces, but is instead reflects really a mercantilist intervention in the currency markets. And the same could be said of the repression of worker rights, that in fact wages in China may have risen a little bit. They ought to be rising a lot. Chinese workers are extremely productive, and as James says, they are entering much more high-tech sectors, so they ought to be earning lots more money than they are. And yet, because the Chinese government is so repressive and has even failed to enforce its own labor laws, they aren't getting the wages they deserve.
James, let me ask you about the inside politics of this. Help us understand the Communist Party. We know a lot of people in the party have made a lot of money. I mean, they've benefited by China's growth. At the same time, we're reading recently, New York Times had a piece on a professor, Wang Hui, at Tsinghua University, and the new left in China advocating a Chinese alternative to neoliberal market economy, looking to guarantee the welfare of 800 million peasants there, looking to the Communist Party leadership at some point as a force for change in favor of working Chinese. Do you see that happening, or some seeds of that happening at some point?
It's a very interesting question. I think there are two or three major pressures here. The first is that the Chinese economy, or the Chinese government that believes it controls the economy, has to create 24 million new jobs every year. That's the equivalent of solving Europe's long-term unemployment problem, or more than solving it, every single year.
To keep unemployment in check, presumably, you're saying.
To keep unemployment in check, and therefore to keep social instability at bay. That's the first issue. So every policy the Chinese government has to take or takes has to bear in mind that it needs to create those jobs. Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons why wages are kept artificially low, as Thea says. The other issue is that the Communist Party is, and the whole Chinese system is very anomalous in this globalized world that we live in. Mm-hmm. China is the first country to have risen to prominence under Pax Americana since the Second World War, that has a system utterly different from that we have in the West. In other words, it's not a democracy, it's a single-party state. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that means that everything must flow from a single source of authority. And labor welfare, labor rights are included in that. That's why no organization in China is independent of the Communist Party. And that's why they see, you know, their inability to admit an independent trade union network.
But at some point, does that bring the party around to needing to realign with worker interests, higher wages, for its own political strength, stability?
Well, I would say that higher wages are definitely going to happen in China over the next 5 years, but not because of what the Communist Party wants, simply because of economics. China has really been transformed in the last 20 years, and where the source of these very low wages really is the extreme poverty of people living in rural China, who, according to various economic historians I quote in my book, are earning roughly what they earned 1,000 years ago in the Tang Dynasty. When they move to the factories, they're actually doing a lot better than they were doing on the farm. But what's happening now is that rural China is developing very quickly too. Service sector industries are growing up all over rural China, and farmers are doing better as well. So when that begins to be entered into the equation of how much you get in a factory, then I think you're going to see wages in factories rise quite quickly. But I think we're probably about 4 to 5 years away from that now.
And in the meantime, that backdrop of 1,000-year-old wage rates, that's a mind-bender. Let me take a call from Carrie in Buford, South Carolina. Hi, Carrie. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well.
One thing concerns me is the subject of, will Americans pay more for product? That's what it boils down to. We talk about all these economic issues and wages and everything else, but any of these increases, which I think is good for humanity, will also raise prices.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've heard people who are at the very low end of the food chain economically, they thank God for Walmart in these small towns.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they would not have this product. Now, if you raise wages, if you do whatever you do that raises is going to raise the product price, you're going to cut out some consumerism. You're going to cut out some goods sold to people at the low end. They'll do without. And then you're also going to take a hunk out of your GNP. What's going to replace that?
Let us pick it up, Carrie. It's a great question. Thea Lee, how do you look at that? You're the union gal here, but you know many Americans are kind of hooked on those, you know, $15 blue jeans. What happens if wages go up, prices go up? Will Americans accept that? And for that matter, will Walmart accept that? Or do they have enough market power to keep them down no matter what anybody thinks?
Well, it's an excellent question, and it's a serious one. First of all, we could actually double or triple wages in a lot of these areas, and you wouldn't see that much impact on the consumer price because it's a very small portion of the price that you actually pay at the cash register. A lot of the other pieces, the retailing, the advertising, the
transportation.
Middleman. Mm-hmm. Transportation is some part of that. But so that's one piece of it, is that there's actually room to treat your workers like human beings and pay them a living wage and still make a profit. The other piece is the profits that these big companies like Walmart spend an enormous amount of money lobbying to keep unions out, to have trade policies that will boost their profits. They could take that money and just pay it to the workers. We'd be all better off. And the third thing is that wages and prices are related. That, sure, if you have a terrible job, a crappy job, you can't earn a living, then you get into a vicious cycle of saying, I need cheap wages, but cheap prices, and I'll do whatever I can to keep that available. But you could look at it the other way, which is we need to create decent jobs here in the United States, and then we can afford to pay maybe a little bit more. It wouldn't have to be all that much more to make sure that workers in other parts of the world had their rights protected. So I think there's actually a win-win solution here where we have decent jobs, decent wages, a stronger manufacturing sector, a more reciprocal trading relationship where we don't have an $800 billion trade deficit, but we're actually able to export more to the rest of the world. And that if all those things were in place, that we would actually see a more prosperous and a more equal kind of distribution of income.
James King, we've just got half a minute. I guess the last word goes to you. Here's a question. Who's stronger, Walmart or the government of China?
That's a good question. I mean, Walmart, is a company, of course, but if you took it as a country, I think it would have a GDP of the 10th largest in the world. So it's a very formidable force. But in China, there's no question that the Chinese government is stronger. That's a very, very powerful force when it comes to operating in China itself.
And right now, with the state union inside Walmart, we've got the inside story here, and it is a fascinating picture. How it unfolds, We'll see. James King, the new book is China Shakes the World, A Titan's Rise and Troubled Future and the Challenge for America. We can sure hear that. James King, thanks very much for joining us from New York.
Thank you.
And Thea Lee, Policy Director and Chief International Economist at the AFL-CIO, with us from Washington, D.C. Thea, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.